And coming up, well, he was once the dandy highwayman. He's now grown into a black and blue-blooded hussar. Talking to Adamant after this. So it's Adam and the Ants on Radio 2, and it's Dog Eats Dog, which would have just been in the chart, or in and around the chart, this time in 1980.
Yeah, it was all a bit of a whirlwind.
Oh, could I imagine, because that whole run-up to Christmas, because Ant Music followed it up in the run-up.
Yeah, Dog Eat Dog was, for me, it's my probably my favourite single from that time, because it's such an unusual sounding record, and once we'd cracked that in the studio to get the sound, we were just, and the ahs, and a lot of experimentation went on making the record. But once we'd got that, that seemed to kind of solidify the kind of, not a formula, but once we'd made that one, we then applied the sound to Ant Music and Kings, and that you know, the single Dog Eat Dog was really the testing point. It was probably the most challenging record.
And is that what you said to the producer in the studio? We want it to sound like, and
I want it to sound like I want to sound like 10,000 Zulus hitting their shields, like, you know. And oh, all right, then we'll do that. Then me and Terry went out and hit everything in sight. Banging bits. I mean, that's the thing with doing, you know, being on tour now. Every single night, I'm trying to get as close to the recording as possible. But when you do you do something in the studio that's kind of loops and. It's all done manually at that point, but I'd layered my vocals and using, you know, hitting, you know, for Dog Eat Dog, we hit, you know, drum cases and bits of wood and everything we could find percussively. We were just layering it and layering it. To produce that live is always a challenge. So every single night I'm singing it, I'm kind of singing it and I'm thinking, what it sounds like on the record, and you've got to kind of get at that middle ground.
Yeah.
So it was I think the same applies with groups like Roxy Music, you know, going to see them live. You know, they couldn't replicate the kind of mood of, say, the first album or the second album, but you got close, you know. And that's why it's quite good to make records that are a bit of a challenge anyway for you.
We'll come back to the tour later on, because there is a new album coming, your first album in, what is it, 17 years, then,
yep.
Is it? And Adamant is the blue-black hussar in Marrying the Gunners, which now it suggests a story, a concept and possibly a film.
Yeah, well, there is title. It's got quite a filmic quality to it. I think looking back on it, you know, it's quite autobiographical.
And what is it? It's a naval phrase.
Yeah, the Marrying the Gunner's Daughter is a naval term for punishment. They'd sort of put him over a cannon and give him a belt in. And I kind of think that was something that, in a way, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to have a great deal of, you know, highs in my life and a lot of success that I wasn't certainly expecting. But it's also interesting to deal with the lows. So the Marrying the Gunner's Daughter thing was, you know, Adamant, it's me, the blue black hussar, is a revisit to the young buck wearing the stripe and that. And what would he look like if he'd maybe walked to Moscow with Napoleon's hussars and come back? Because those guys actually did it. And I did a lot of reading about, you know, these guys actually went there on horses and walked back half dead. And the maturity of that. And Marrying the Gunner's Daughter was basically having gone through that kind of difficult period.
Any particular genre of literature then that you like? Have you got a favourite book at the moment?
Strangely enough, I think when you write a book, I wrote a book, and when you sort of write an autobiography, the discipline of doing it, you go through it. I wonder what other people's other musicians' books are like. So I've been I read about,
there's a can of worms.
Yeah, you read about Johnny Cash, and I just read Pete Townsend's book, which is marvellous. I'm reading Rod Stewart's book, because reading them, it's strange. Although, you know, you think, well, you know, you was in the punk rock sort of, I was part of the punk rock movement, but then you read Pete Townsend's book and it's more or less an identical experience. There's so many similarities of upbringing, you know, the art school thing, trying to sort of, you know, how they got into music. Like, even with Rod, you know, Rod Stewart, like, you know, the first Dylan album sort of changed his life. And you would never in a million years associate that with his voice or who he was or what he developed.
Mm.
But I think it's you know, I love doing what I do. And I think in a way I'm at a point now where I'm interested in the history of what I do. So it's nice to look at other people's experiences and compare them with your own. And they make very good reading. And I really enjoyed doing that.
There's loads more to talk about, including more on the new records and the dates, which are currently halfway through. But let's play a track. We'll play one of the new songs, which you'll find on the forthcoming album. And this is the single. And in the fine tradition of Adamant Records, you have this on the A side, and there's a roaring punk rock tune on the B side. Mm. But the A side is called Call Zombie, which came from where and written about what?
Well, that was a period in my life where I'd sort of got out of music and kind of went to Los Angeles to study acting, and I had quite a, you know, 5 years there working as an actor, which was a break that I needed. I certainly needed a break from it. And then I had about 3 years living in a tiny little town in the middle of Tennessee, right down in the deep south. And basically, I was driving from, I decided to drive to Las Vegas from Miami, and I was going to drive up to Vegas, and halfway along, or a little way into the journey, I stopped in this little tiny town called Dayton, and pulled out a sort of property magazine which they had there, and I thought it was A-frame house, and it was really cheap, and I thought, oh, and I'll go up there and had a look at it, and I just said, well, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. So before I knew it, I'd kind of bought the house and lived up there, and you know, my daughter was conceived there, and it was literally, you know, it was, I was wearing dungarees, had a 54 red pickup that I bought off a local guy who put like a V8 engine in it, and I nearly killed myself driving it. So put your foot down, it was like this. But people were just genuinely very, very, very genuinely friendly and kind. And it was such a place of beauty. It was staggering every morning to look out on this. And you know, the lyric sort of came out of that. But also, noticeably, my next-door neighbour was in the American Navy. He'd been in submarines, and he was a big country and western fan. And he was quite an oldish guy, but called Ron. And he had a Harley Davidson, and he'd just take me off on his Harley and visit his mates in the sort of backwoods. So drive me miles out into the backwoods, and it's quite scary actually some of the time. And you go and meet his mates, oh, this is Adam, and they go, hi there, and that was it. But I noticed that the local towns, the local little theatres there, each town had a little time, and you have like Johnny Cash playing there.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash used to go back and play these places. Mel Haggard would be there. These massive country stars would still go back to their roots and play these small towns. So the idea of country, real country, and these superstars going back on a regular basis was quite an eye opener for me, and it was they really do love their music down there.
Yeah. Mm. And all that in the course of the next 3.5 minutes. It's Adam Ant on Radio 2, and this is called Zombie. The new single called Zombie. Do you ever have to sort of self-edit yourself? Do you find yourself thinking, no, that's too much, that's too personal? Have you ever got to that point where you thought, no, actually, I'm willing to share and I've written a biography, but that's too far?
That's the that's one of the hardest things about writing an autobiography, because I did write my autobiography.
To other pop stars who have ghostwriters, everyone.
Well, I understand that. I mean, they obviously don't have time. I think My autobiography is quite sort of waltz and all, because I've always kept journals. And really, I think the difference between a sort of autobiography and memoirs, and memoirs are your recollections, so you know, they're not as detailed as an autobiography. With autobiography, you know, it's dates, times, that's a great deal of work. But I think it's just really other people's feelings, primarily your family. You know, you have to protect your mum and dad's feelings. And the people who, I think, write very successful books are usually do it later in life, where a lot of people are passed on, and then they can write pretty much what happened to them. But it's one of the hardest you know, challenges I've done, to actually sit down and look at all the writings and the notes and the diaries that I kept. And it's one of my ambitions to actually just publish the first two volumes of diary that I did during the punk period, which starts in 77 and goes through to the night before going on Top of the Pop. So that's actually a pretty much day-to-day catalogue of what it was like in punk rock London, which I'd like to do one day word for word. But as you say, you have to bear in mind other people's feelings.
Are there any points in your life where you look back and you sort of, you don't in a way recognise yourself, it's you, but it's not you?
A few towards the, you know, towards the end of the sort of music side. It was getting to a point where you're kind of giving it your best shot. And I think having success, having number one records, is obviously a great thing to do, because you are competitive, you're a competitive person. But you do buy into this kind of chart competitiveness. So you're almost like a prize fighter. You know, like I'm number one, so I'm the champ. And then, and I wrote a line: when you get to number one, the only way is down. If you have a sticky patch, they start looking around. And I didn't realise how true that was. Personally, that was my own error to buy into that. But you have to be quite a strong personality not to. But now it's pretty much, there were times when, you know, I don't put out a record that I'm going to apologise for, or that I think it's not finished. You put the record out, you put all your effort into it, and for one reason or another, it doesn't have the commercial success that the other ones have had, the ones before have had, either another band's come along and taken over. And that's when you're really tested as a, not just a musician, but as a kind of person, as a writer, because you have to stay true to the fact, well, that was the idea, that's what I want to do, and you have to be quite strong to hold on to yourself at that point.
I felt at points that because you wanted to make each album slightly different, there were times where I think the media, some of the fans, the, you know, more peripheral fans, just couldn't keep up.
You do lose a lot of...
I mean, you were changing more than Bowie, weren't you, at one point?
I did make that a kind of premise, like a blank sheet. You know, and because I was doing the videos as well, storyboarding those and doing those as well, it was because I come from an art school background, that was the way we were trained to do a project. And so to me, each album had to be fresh. The music, you know, the instrumentation had to be different. Everything had to be completely different. And you're right. You do lose a certain amount of your audience. You change too much. And the bands that have really gone on into great longevity have pretty much kept not only the original lineups, but they've actually kept their kind of identity, like AC/DC or the Stones, or, you know, they've kept an identity that you know, feeds the sort of, you know, they change it a bit, but it feeds the kind of the thing that is appealing. And I just really just deliberately sometimes was getting into musical areas that, you know, I was just having to rely on, you know, bring a brass section in on Goody Two Shoes and singing them I don't want to sound like that, which is good. But, you know, now it's in a way, this album is a kind of, I looked across, you know, all the albums and I thought, well, what's my favourite? And it being King. So that was a starting point.
Yeah.
And to sort of update the ideas on that and the character on that without just replicating it.
We should mention some of the other things, as well as the album, the double album, which is coming out, the new records. What else? There's a documentary, isn't there? There's a documentary which is being filmed by one of the band, the Claxons.
It's got, you know, Mark Ronson in it, Charlotte Rampling's in it, and Alan Jones, the artist, the pop artist, is in it. I go back to see him because me and Johnny Rotten turned up on his doorstep once, and I gave him some artwork that I'd made for him, and we go back and he talks about that. So it's really some of my favourite people in the film.
So it's album, documentary film. There was talk of a fashion label as well. Is that?
Yeah, the stuff I'm wearing on stage, the waistcoats and shirts. A friend of mine, Rob Lucas, at a company called Pimpernel, we sort of designed the stuff together, and it's this brocade menswear. It's kind of it's unisex anyway, but it's extremely coutured. You know, and it's made by the same people that made the originals for the Light Brigade in 1854. So it's quite, you know, expensive clobber. Yeah. But I'm more or less just styling it, and certain people are saying, oh, you know, we'd like to wear that, and can you make us one? But down the line, it would be nice, time permitting, to do something that was based upon, you know, the styles and some of the clothes I've worn on stage. Mm. Because they've been, when I first did it, it got, you know, it was being copied and put out there by so many people, and not very well.
Yeah.
But at least this stuff's the real deal.
So, right, to recap, biography, album, documentary, and an involvement in clothes. That, I work out, makes you our version of Jay-Z.
Yeah.
All you need now is a fragrance. I don't know what Adamant perfume would smell of.
I'd have to think about that one.
Tonight, good luck. You're in Sheffield tonight. That's a plug in Sheffield, and then I think it's Manchester tomorrow as the tour continues on its way to London. Good luck with the rest of it, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Your opinions here at Radio 2 on your favourite number 2 singles of all time. Have a look on the website, get your votes in. That went to number two over the Christmas period of 1980 from Adam and the Ants. Ants music, and thank you very much to Adam for talking to us. And it's Johnny Marr after this.
London Calling. From the first broadcast.